All right, welcome to another episode of Peak Health Unlocked. I am one of your hosts, Mark Champagne, alongside
Dr. Rhett Langley
and Dr. Philip Gallegos.
We interview experts discussing the latest science, technology, and wellness practices to help unlock your peak health.
Make sure to stick around at the end of the episode where we have a deep dive and talk about the most interesting topics from the interview.
And this podcast would not be possible without the support of Thrive Performance and Regenerative Medicine, a team prepared to go all in with you to craft your personalized peak health plan. Visit the link in the show notes for a range of services.
Thanks for being here and have a thriving day.
Today we are speaking with Dr. Matt Dawson, who is a physician and founder and CEO of a genomics-based personalized medicine company called Wild Health. They specialize in providing holistic treatment based on individuals' DNA and other biometrics to help them achieve optimal health and performance. But Matt, just for the purpose of this series, we're starting each conversation with the same question, just to get some perspective from you. And the question is, what does longevity mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still reeling right now from Rhett talking about a pandemic. I had no idea. I'm Googling seriously right now to figure out what he's talking about. But so longevity, I mean, there's the obvious answer, like how long are you going to live? But that's really not what it means to me at all. We at Wild Health, we talk a lot about longevity. We have genomics-based longevity program and a longevity track that we put people in. And so people think of us as trying to extend how long someone lives, but that's really not the goal. Like, we really want to optimize people's life now and then keep it there for a long time, because obviously getting to be 80 to 90 and just hanging on is a very different thing than really thriving in old age. And there's actually a quote by Sophia Loren, which I really like, where she said, "There is a fountain of youth. It's in your mind, your talents, the creativity you bring to your life and the lives of people you love. And when you learn to tap this source, you will truly have defeated age." So we get people excited to come to us because we talk about longevity and the geeky science stuff. But honestly, that's just kind of an entry point and a gateway to get them in, optimize their health with the biomarkers and things like that, and then really try to help them figure out how to do those things, use their talents and mind and creativity to affect the people that they love. So in my mind, that's what true longevity is, finding that fountain of youth that Sophia Loren. And obviously, we got to keep people alive too. And we've got a lot of cool ways to do that and extend life. But the quality of life and that health span is what I think about when I hear longevity.
It's definitely been a theme over the last few conversations for the answers around that question. Because I think on the outside, a lot of people think, oh, okay, we're pushing the boundaries of living past 100 at this point. But I have to say, everyone that's been on the show so far really has focused on the quality of those years, right? And the last thing you want is to be 110 and just, you can't move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I feel bad for giving the same answers to everybody else, but if everybody has the same kind of theme, then you got to think there's some truth there. It's good that we're all thinking about this in the same way.
Yeah,
I think that's also the reason we're presenting this in a docuseries, so we can at least find out some patterns.
Yeah, that's the key for sure. Well, and I like the idea of you mentioned the mind, right? That is a bit unique in that answer, and just flipping someone's mindset to, what is important, or at least what I was hearing, like what is important for you when it comes to your life and the length of your life and those quality years, right? It reminds me of like the classic, you can't fuel your happiness with things. Or you can, I guess, but that well runs dry pretty fast at one point.
Yeah, for sure. And everyone gets that realization at some point. And the hope is that you do earlier before you've wasted a large amount of your life on things and pushing towards things that seem to be important but are really pretty superficial. So
go for it, guys. I know you've got a ton of questions for Matt.
Yeah, I'll actually just kick it off real quick. I know that we're going to jump into some more specific granular science items, but I want to start this off by just asking or bringing to light some things that you guys do at Wild Health. And I'll use the term precision medicine, because I know you guys have created and are doing some things over there that are unique. So can you just start with telling us a little bit about what you guys do at Wild Health and what it means to perform precision medicine, and then obviously how that relates to longevity afterwards?
For sure. So Mike and I, Mike Mallon, who we founded Wild Health, the reason we did is because we just saw the medical system was broken the way it was traditionally practiced. We were treating people, as you all know, as MDs, we were treating people with based on statistics and epidemiology, like what works for most people. And that's great 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, because we would just take the approach that was statistically most likely to help. And if we were wrong, well, we gave it was a good shot. Let's try something else. That kind of trial and error approach, we realized we could do better. We had some personal health experiences. Mike, for example, had some really difficulties with cholesterol, even though we thought we were doing all the right things. And by sequencing our own DNA and genetics, we saw, for example, Mike's cholesterol, which was really high. I had recommended to him a diet which works for most people, works for 85% of people to lower lipids, and he got worse. He started on a statin, which his doctor put him on, and he had really bad muscle breakdown and myopathy. And when we looked at his genetics, this was several years ago, we realized we could have predicted both of those things. He needed to be on a diet based on his DNA that was almost exactly the opposite of what works for me and works for most people. And he had a genetic reason that he was almost guaranteed to have muscle breakdown and myopathy from the statin. So when we saw this personally, we really started digging into the science. We saw that physicians were not using genomics, and the science was there. We could. But it took us a long time of studying, trial and error with that, reading everything we could to figure out how to apply it to patients. And then our journey started with the DNA and the genomics, sequencing our friends and family and others and kind of giving them quote-unquote precision recommendations. And then it evolved over time. So what we learned is that genomics are important. It's kind of like your human operating system, looking at someone's DNA, but it's not the whole picture, because no matter what your genetics and DNA are, these genes, you're turning good ones and bad ones off daily with what you do, with what you eat, your exercise levels, your stress levels. So we wanted to take that human potential of the DNA and combine it with a really deep dive into blood work and biometrics and see where you are right now. And then we could develop the real precision recommendations. There are a lot of companies out there that will look at your genetics and say, eat this or do that. And that's good, but we think it's not enough. So for example, when we come up with what's the perfect diet for someone, it depends somewhat on genetics. If you have a VDR SNP, you may need more vitamin D, but then what is your vitamin D level? If you live in Florida and you're working outside all the time, your vitamin D may be fine. You may have corrected that with lifestyle. If you have a FADS2 polymorphism, you need more omega-3. Well, if you're eating a ton of fish, you may be overcoming that. Or if you live in middle America and never eat fish, we may need to put you on a fish oil supplement if you don't like fish, or have you eat more fish. So every kind of lifestyle factor, we would combine the DNA, the blood work, and then patient preference, because obviously the perfect diet for you isn't the one that's perfect for your DNA and blood work. It's the one that fits with your DNA, your blood work, and it's something you enjoy and will eat. So it's a complicated process. And so at Wild Health, we have developed with artificial intelligence and some algorithms, a way to upload DNA, biometrics, patient preference, and get true precision recommendations. So that's what we do. And then we come up with objective measures. This is our goal. This is where we want to get to. And then we kind of partner with people to help get them there. So it's a long answer to a short question of what we do, but it's kind of been an evolution over time. So that's where we've gotten to where we are now.
I love it. I mean, the question that comes to mind as you're saying that is just, you know, what's been how do people receive this? Because it's so different from traditional medicine that has been just programmed in all of our minds for decades, right?
Yeah. People get it. People get it immediately. They understand that they're different. Like everyone is different. What works for one person doesn't work for everybody. So it's not difficult to explain to a patient why this is important. To be honest, frequently we're having to kind of take a step back and say, look, these recommendations are very precise and they're better than what you would normally get, but we still have to follow along, and humans are complicated. So we still have to have the partnership with the patient as well. But as far as how people respond, like people understand, I mean, it just makes sense. It's surprising that medicine hasn't gotten here more quickly.
For sure. For sure.
Matt, I know you guys get very, very extensive into the onboarding form. You go into like what time you eat, who do you eat with, do you have a mental fitness practice, spiritual practice. You guys get very granular with that, combined with the biomarkers, including blood, urine, microbiome. And I know you also do some longevity testing based on, I believe you guys have switched over to using methylation in the Horvath clock. Can you speak to us a little bit about that, and what's the difference between that and telomere length? And are we able to affect our biological age versus our chronological age?
Yeah, it's a great question. And you hit a few things I think are important to kind of go back to before talking about longevity. You mentioned who you eat with, when you eat, your spiritual practice, things like that. Everyone's always excited about the DNA and the blood work and all that. But we found that this really ancient method of treating patients, which I don't know, in medical school, you all probably didn't learn about it because I didn't either, but it's called a conversation. It turns out that's also important, like using this tool of our mouth and our ears as a diagnostic tool. All of those things really matter, like people's lifestyle. It's the genetics. Everybody thinks about DNA as being a cutting edge thing. It's about 20% of your result when it comes to health and longevity, and those lifestyle factors are critical to understand. The difficulty is it takes time, and that's something that we don't have much time as physicians, but we can't ignore those things. So we really do try to dig in to those for sure. Your specific question about longevity, there are good ways to measure it, some better than others. Telomere length, I think people were really interested and excited about for a long time, and there's probably something there. Personally, when we look at the data, we don't think the measurements are accurate enough. We've had experience of, we'll, sometimes when we're testing out a DNA methylation test or a measure of telomere length or things like that, we'll send the same tests for the same person, but like 3 days in a row or the same day even, and we get different answers. And that tells us that this is not really a really reliable measure. And that's what we think telomere length is. We don't think it's a really great measure yet. Hopefully it'll get better. The DNA methylation tests, those are interesting. We also will use phenotypic kind of calculators and other things as well to calculate age. So for example, there's real age, which is a free thing people can take online. There's inner age that Inside Tracker uses. There's a few others that are free or cheap. And then the DNA methylation tests are a little more expensive if you want an objective measure that's not based on questionnaires. So the DNA methylation tests we do use, but those are constantly evolving as well. There's different ones. Right now, we were using DNA age, but we think probably Elysium is probably on the cutting edge of that, and we're kind of switching to their test right now. So that's what we use to measure someone's age. You did ask a specific question about, can we affect that? We believe we can, based on the literature and our experience. There was the great study, which you all have probably spoken about, but where they actually did a study looking at, can we reverse biologic age with just personalized medications. It was the study where they put people on metformin, DHEA, zinc, maybe one or two other things, and they did. So they were able to, over the course of a year, compared to a control group, reverse people's biologic age by a year and a half. So the control group aged by a year, so it was really a 2.5 year difference. So that was the first study we had saying this is possible. And I'll tell you from our anecdotal experience, we have had success. Our patients are 6 months later having improvements in their DNA age. We haven't collated that data yet to give hard numbers on averages, but we really have seen that every patient that I've had, their biologic age has went down, and hopefully we'll publish that in the future as well. But we believe that, again, after that long answer I gave you, the short answer is yes, we think we can reverse or at least slow down biologic age.
Yeah, we agree. We think that you can as well from everything that we've been learning. You did mention a few things, and we want to break those down and discuss those. But one of the ones that you mentioned, which is metformin, which is a little bit controversial, is that something that you guys are putting all your patients on, certain patients? Because there are, you know, there are some drawbacks to metformin, and you can discuss those. But, you know, one of the big things is you guys take care of a lot of athletes, and it does affect athletic performance. So if you can touch on should patients be taking metformin?
Yeah, you're exactly right. It is very, like everything we do, very personalized. So a 70-year-old with a hemoglobin A1C of over 6 certainly will get a longevity benefit. The data seems pretty clear on that. A professional athlete will be harmed. We think the data is pretty clear on that because it will have performance effects. And then you get into the middle, someone like me, not a professional athlete, but I still want to perform, and I'm 39. So my thinking on this has changed and evolved over time. 2 years ago, I was taking metformin. Now I'm not. So where that cutoff is of who we treat, we have a couple algorithms, and what we do is we put age goals, is it more performance or longevity based, and then hemoglobin A1C and a couple other measures. And then we decide whether it's beneficial for someone or not. And right now, that's the best we can do. Some people are clear cut, like I said, pro athlete or older person with insulin resistance and a high hemoglobin A1C. And then you got people in the middle, like probably you all and myself. And I don't know exactly where that cutoff is, but it clearly helps people, some people, and harms others.
Awesome, Matt. Can you also, while we're talking about it, can you touch on peptides as well? I know that peptides are cool. They're new. There's a lot of ongoing research. There's a wide variety of usages. Can you just talk about what you guys have done in the past, or maybe what you're planning on doing in the future, and how that, in regards to longevity?
Yeah, for sure. So, peptides are very interesting. We take a kind of genomics approach to peptides, as well as goals and biometrics. So metformin, we talked about, that's not a peptide, it's just a medication, but there are some peptides like MOT-SC, for example. One of the problems with metformin is a bit of a kind of mitochondrial toxin a little bit. It's part of the reason why you get a decreased performance. But then you have something like MOT-SC, which is a peptide, which we think could lead to probably increased longevity and performance. But we, a lot of times, we'll reserve that for patients who they may have low PGC1 alpha enzyme, for example. So low expression when we look at their genetics. So if someone does have a low PGC1 alpha and they're aging, and we know their PGC1 alpha enzyme expression decreases over age, then a peptide like MOT-SC may be helpful for them. There's also, you talked about telomere length. So there are a few SNPs when we look at genetics that may lead to shortened telomere length. And if someone has several of those, then we may consider Epitalon potentially to help elongate those telomeres or slow down the shortening of those. So peptides are difficult because there's not a ton of research around them, but could be very helpful. And earlier we mentioned the biologic age study where that was reversed, and one of the interventions they used, which I didn't mention then, was growth hormone. So seeing how growth hormone can potentially help slow down aging because it decreases over time, there are peptides like Ipamorelin and CJC1295 that could increase your body's endogenous production of growth hormones. So instead of supplementing directly with growth hormones, there are probably some issues with that. We use that peptide as well. So there is a suite of peptides, and we could talk about them each individually or specifically if you'd like, but they can be really helpful. I think it's important to talk to patients, though, about, you know, hey, look, we don't see big risks from the literature, but the literature isn't robust, so we don't know. We got to have a little bit of humility when talking about peptides, because there are clearly benefits there, but there could be some downsides as well. So peptides are a hot topic, but it's one that I like to approach with some humility, because we don't have 20, 30 years of experience and large studies with them.
You mentioned PGC1 alpha. Do you guys look at other ways to activate that NRF pathway and activate mitochondrial biogenesis? Do you guys have any other tricks that you guys use to do that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that's a great point. Peptides are expensive and they could have side effects. There are other ways to upregulate that mitochondrial biogenesis as well, just like cold exposure. So I could just tell you about my day today because it's been kind of a mitochondrial biogenesis day. I've done several things. I went for a run this morning. Exercise, we know, increases mitochondrial biogenesis. I did some high intensity stuff after the run. I did sauna after that. I did a cold shower after that, and I didn't eat till a little after noon today. So I was fasting, even though I had a fair amount of activity. So all of those things have been shown to increase mitochondrial density, and I wasn't having to give myself an injection with MOD-SC to do it. So we do try to lean on people a little bit to say, hey, look, there are natural ways before you spend your money and inject yourself. So yeah, that's a great point.
Well, I love that you touched on that because from just doing some of the research for this show, it seems pretty clear that, you know, the whole reason or a good part of the reason Wild Health started and why you're involved in this work is like you wanted to make this kind of peak health accessible, right? For any social status or any type of income level. So it's always fun to learn all of the different methods that you can achieve some of these results, right? And kind of put together your personalized stack, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. And it may be for different people, we use different stacks at different times. For people our age, probably don't need to do the peptides. We probably have pretty good levels of PGC1 alpha and just the natural ways are enough and without the risk of the side effects. Whereas get to be 60 or 70 and you may need to push a little harder and add the peptides. So not only is it individualized and personalized, it's also individualized based on where you are in time as mm-hmm. well. So it really is again, that ancient tool of the conversation is important to have with the patient as well.
I just have one follow-up on, or just tactical question. When you mentioned, you know, your hot cold therapy, you know, like how long are you spending in a sauna? How long is the cold shower for you, or what do you find is working well?
So that's a really good question. And both of those I look at and I talk about these when talking to patients, like it's exercise because everybody gets exercise. So with the sauna, I think you work up to it. Like if you were going to start running, you've never ran before, half a mile, you're pretty gassed. And you go much further than that, you may be getting into overtraining and hurting yourself. You got to work up if you want to run a marathon. Similar with the sauna. You get in the sauna, some people, they get it up to 140, 150 degrees in 2 minutes. They're just too uncomfortable and they got to get out. That's fine. You kind of work up. You're going to get some heat shock proteins from that little amount. And then every day you do a little more. The same thing with cold exposure. And so for sauna, for example, now I'm at a point where I have the sauna I did this morning is an infrared sauna, near infrared sauna. But I had far infrared as well, kind of hacked it to kind of doubly get heat in there. And I did some kettlebell swings in it. So that's pretty intense. And I could not have done that several years ago.
No kidding.
when it comes to, and sometimes my wife gets worried, I come out of sauna and she's like, you look like you were about to die. And but if someone did that right off the bat, maybe they would.
So, yeah, exactly.
And same thing with cold. It's when I first read about cold exposure and I turned my shower all the way to cold, I thought I was going to die. You can't breathe. But now I don't use hot water in the shower, period. I get in with a cold. I stay until I'm done showering and I get out. So, but you have to work up to that. I was not comfortable doing that at first. So my answer to both of those is just kind of what you can tolerate and you just work up over time. We do know there is a dose dependent response. For sauna, for example, there's good studies on the effects, for example, increasing your growth hormone. We talked about that as potentially a good thing for longevity. And depending on how hot it is and how long you're in there, you get an increase in, there's a dose response curve there. You get more increase in your growth hormone response. And same thing with how much heat shock proteins you produce. And same thing for the cold, your response to that does increase over time. So yeah, I think you work up just like you would with exercise.
Yeah, Philip and I actually completed a challenge that went on for 75 days, and it had a long list of things we had to adhere to. But I would say the most difficult one was the 5-minute cold showers every morning. I don't think I ever got used to that. So
yeah, it's also a great way to save money on your water bill because you want to get out quickly. Yeah. You get good at 60-second showers.
Yeah. So Matt, one thing I wanted to touch on, you know, Philip and I are in the fellowship, the Wild Health Fellowship right now. It's an amazing experience. One aspect of that fellowship is learning about your own health, you know, a physician, heal thyself. And at Wild Health, they work with health coaches, which is an awesome idea. We want to try to incorporate that at Thrive. However, you do get to understand and know yourself very well, which is the point. And if I'm ever going to be older than chronologically I'm supposed to be, it's because of my sleep. So I've recently talked to my health coach, and I wear an Oura ring in my sleep. I've worked very hard on it, but it still needs some work. And she's asked me to give up that data. So I'm pretty nervous, but obviously it's something I need to work on. So I wanted to just ask you, what do you guys do for sleep? What do you see as the biggest issue in regards to sleep today? And you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's very insightful for you to be thinking about that, because it's just critical for longevity. We every year in the United States, we do a crazy experiment called daylight savings time, where we lose an hour of sleep and rates of heart attack and stroke spike in the ER. So to think about what we're doing to ourselves by chronically being sleep deprived is pretty scary. So there are a lot of things you can do to improve your sleep. Instead of getting into all the details, the way we approach it is, one, we track. So we have objective data, like you're wearing your Oura ring. So how much deep sleep you're getting, how much REM sleep you're getting, not just the total amount. And once we kind of diagnose what the problem is, then we can dig into specific interventions. I think the way to globally think about sleep is to imagine yourself 1,000 years ago. So wherever you live 1,000 years ago, what your life would be like, and then look at how different it is today when it comes to sleep. 1,000 years ago, you'd be getting up, you'd be, when the sun comes up, you'd be outside most of the day getting exposure to light early morning. You get a really strong circadian rhythm because it's light in the morning, gets dark at night. And once the sun starts going down, the blue light fades, which blue light is what suppresses melatonin. Your melatonin production increases. You go to sleep pretty soon after it gets dark. It's cooler at night than it is in the day. So all of these things led to good sleep. And today we've just totally messed all of that up. We get up when our alarm goes off. It's not related to the sun. We're inside most of the day. We're in temperature-controlled environments where it's the same temperature all day and all night. We're not getting any of those ancestral cues. And then at night, when the sun goes down, that's fine. All of our lights are on. So we're getting constant blue light. And most people relax at the end of the day by watching TV or looking at their screens, which the most pure source of blue light, which suppresses melatonin, comes from screens. So we're doing all these negative things, and then we expect to have good sleep, and it just doesn't work. So we know we're not going to go to living in a cave like we would have 1,000 or several thousand years ago. But if we can just do little things like getting some morning light, trying not to use an alarm clock when possible, getting some exercise and movement during the day, and avoiding blue light at night, some of those things really make a big difference. And then if they don't, then we can get technical and look, is it a deep sleep problem or a REM problem? And we approach solving those in different ways. If it's a REM problem, then REM, that is at the end of the night. So either usually the most common reasons that's off is your alarm is going off too early, so you're cutting off that opportunity for REM that's later in your sleep cycle. Or you may have an acetylcholine deficiency, for example. You may have a PEMT polymorphism that means you need to eat more choline or acetylcholine. If deep sleep is your problem, then you're probably either not going to bed early enough because your appetite for deep sleep is the first half of the night, or all the blue light at night is just affecting the quality of the first half of your night sleep, and we need to solve that problem. So tracking it, the diagnosis of what's the problem, and then just trying to design as close to ancestral living as possible are the major ways that we improve people's sleep.
Yeah, the follow-up there, I think for me is, you know, when I got that Oura Ring, and I think anybody that's high functioning or type A, their sleep is very regimented. They have all the stuff that they feel like they need to do throughout the day. So they set aside 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, or 8 hours. But when you actually put the ring on, you realize that you're probably not getting the amount of sleep that you think you're getting if you're calculating from the last time you remember to when you wake up. So that was a huge glaring issue with me. I was like, oh yeah, I'm appropriating 6 hours, but I might have gotten 4.5 hours of sleep. So,
yeah, exactly. I mean, I remember when I first got my Oura Ring, I would get 10 to 15 minutes of deep sleep each night, which was horrific. But I made several interventions. We could talk about any of them, but I'm looking right now at my Oura Ring app, and last night I got an hour and 55 minutes of deep sleep.
Wow.
And that is probably a year and a half, 2 years of work, but that's a massive difference. And what that does for my longevity, I have no idea how to quantify it, but it's got to be a really big, big difference.
Well, can you share one of the biggest changes that you noticed, the biggest result, sure. I guess you could say?
Yeah, I can give you a few. Because
sure.
The reason why I want to give you a few is because all the time we hear people are trained by traditional medicine to think incorrectly about solving their problems. What I mean by that is we know that if someone has a UTI, okay, well, let's identify the bacteria. We'll give a specific antibiotic for that bacteria. We solve the problem. With most problems, it's multifactorial. It's when someone says, what do I need to do to improve my sleep? It's like asking me, that Picasso painting is beautiful. What color makes it beautiful?
Sure.
They all work together. So for me, what happened, my journey was several things. Number one, the temperature. I already mentioned temperature makes a big difference. My wife and I, probably the closest, we would have an argument almost every night and a fight, constant back and forth between the temperature and the room. So we solved that problem by getting an Uller. So an Uller is a device. It lays underneath my side of the bed and it keeps my side cool, and then she can be as hot as she wants. That made a big difference for me.
You just added longevity to my marriage.
Yeah. It's when I just found out the other day, I haven't gotten this yet, but there's Uller's making, apparently I need to look it up. Somebody told me they have a weighted blanket that is cooling as well.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they do.
I'm so excited about that. I got a weighted blanket and I haven't gotten to use it because my wife stole it, but I was worried I'd be too hot anyway. So I'm going to get a cooling weighted blanket. The one time I used our weighted blanket that I got, I used it for a nap. I was going to do something that night, and I can never nap more than 30, 45 minutes. And I went to sleep with a weighted blanket and I woke up like 2.5 hours later. So it's a weighted blanket is a cool device as well. But the cool part made a big impact. The other thing for me, genetics, we love genetics. So I have a FAAH, fatty acid amide hydrolase gene that meant that I would probably respond pretty well to CBD. So when I tried it, yeah, big bump in my deep sleep. And then the third thing for me is the blue light. We used to watch a TV episode or something before bed and completely cut that out. I haven't watched TV at night in I don't know how long. But those three things were really the things for me that made a big difference, is the CBD, the keeping the temperature cold, and no blue light at night.
Well, thanks for sharing that. I think the theme of the conversation, I mean, you're providing so many different jumping off points for people that And you mentioned the reason why, but just so really anyone can pick up or try some of this stuff, right? And experiment, which is so helpful. Go ahead.
And how you try them is important too. Sorry break back in, but it's not good enough just to try something, but to objectively measure, I think, is important. And that's what's great about the Oura Ring. Like, we can do these N of one experiments and then get that quick feedback. So I do encourage people to not just try things, but run real experiments. Try it for a week and then look at your data the week before and the week after, and try to be objective about what works and what doesn't.
Sure. So Oura Ring, if you're listening, we've name dropped that brand several times. So we're open to sponsorships at this point.
funny thing about Oura is we had a discount code with them, but they have just blown up during COVID, because it's also a really cool tracking tool to see, like, look at your HRV and heart rate to predict
the
viral infection. And now they don't even have any discount codes for anyone. So they're doing pretty well right now.
No kidding. I love the pivot a little bit, or maybe it's not a pivot, because I think really anything that's been discussed so far relies on a really important object on the top of our shoulders, our mind, to make a lot of these decisions. So I'd love to know what your stance is, or what you're doing personally to protect and allow your mind to thrive for a nice, healthy, long life.
Yeah. It's a good question. It's one that I have not done great on in the past, and just recently I've really realized how important it is. We, for example, at Wild Health, we've just developed these separate tracks for people if they want to focus on brain optimization or longevity. And one of the tracks we developed is a mindfulness track. So my wife is a psychiatrist. She's a big proponent of MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. And incorporating more mindfulness into my life, meditation, some real downtime, is just, to me, has made a big difference. It's you can say you feel better or you're thinking more clearly, but I've also just noticed increases in my heart rate variability and these other objective measures as well. So having a mindfulness practice, I think, is one of the best things you can do, not just for now, but there's actually good science on it increasing longevity. It also decreases cardiovascular risk and chronic pain and so many other things. So just any sort of mindfulness practice, and there's so many, I hesitate to kind of name one, but just incorporating one to start is a good place. And then if it doesn't work for you, just know there are other ways as well. There's so many great apps and programs, but having some sort of mindfulness or spiritual practice is really critical, I think, just for human beings in general.
Go ahead, guys. Thanks for that, Matt.
So, Matt, this will be a pivot, because when you're talking about longevity, this is the big one that's real popular right now and everybody talks about it. So NAD, so we can't not do a longevity podcast and not talk about NAD. Can you talk about, what are its purported benefits? Is it something that everybody should be taking as far as like an IV or these NAD precursors? Is it something that you guys implement with all your patients, or is it case-by-case basis?
It's certainly case by case. It's probably the most important longevity molecule. We know it decreases with age. We know there are some good smaller studies, some really good rodent studies on it increasing longevity. It's hard to do longevity studies with humans. So anyone that's interested, I don't really see a downside so much to NAD other than the cost and the time and just adding something on. So anyone that's interested, I certainly think an NAD precursor like nicotinamide riboside or NMN are great. We also do IV NAD, but it costs a fair amount of money. And so if people want to do it, we're all for it. We think it probably makes a difference, but I try to be honest about not great long-term data on it definitely working, but the benefits probably definitely outweigh the risks, and we will do it for anyone that wants to spend the money on it.
Is there anyone that you favor over the other as far as effect that your patients have benefited from?
Yeah, it's so there's so many smart people that have strong opinions on this. you look at David Sinclair, who wrote Lifespan, and he likes NMN. We've interviewed David. I've talked to him about this, and he really can't give me a great reason. That's the one that he studied and he's seen the most evidence for. You talk to the great scientists behind like True Niagen and Elysium products, and they think nicotinamide riboside is the way to go. And then other people definitely prefer NAD. I am pretty agnostic when it comes to that. And it just depends if someone has the money for IV NAD. Usually IV medications are more efficacious. But you have to have an IV and injection. So we kind of mix it up. I mean, we have some patients who will take NR. There's a, now I'm blanking on, what is the Thorne product that has the nicotinamide riboside and also has quercetin and the methyl donor as well. I'm blanking on it. It's my favorite oral NR product. But then we also will send IM NAD to people if they want to inject. And if you ever injected IM NAD, you certainly can feel the flush. So you feel like it's definitely doing something. So as far as which form, I'm pretty agnostic. And we have some of our patients that just do all of them. They're like, why not? And they've got the money and the means. And so they'll do NR and NMN and IMNAD and occasional IVNAD. And I think that's a fine approach.
Yeah, along those same lines, what are your thoughts on resveratrol? Because I know Dr. Sinclair is a big proponent of resveratrol and something that he studied. Is resveratrol and other compounds like that, is it something that people should be looking into and adding to their longevity protocols?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks. That helps. That reminded me of what the Thorne product is. Resveracel is what I was thinking of. And that's why I like it. It's a combination of resveratrol, NR, and quercetin, and it's got one other thing in it I'm forgetting. But yes, I think resveratrol is great. Trans resveratrol is the active form. So if you're going to get a resveratrol supplement, you want to get the trans form of that. But I think that the evidence for resveratrol is pretty strong. And again, it's one also that no real downsides to it. So I think, yeah, that's a big one that anyone could probably get on the bandwagon of that. And it's not that expensive either.
Matt, I know we're hitting you with a bunch of different topics at once, but I think that this is really important for us because we were excited about this interview. We just knew that you were very knowledgeable in a lot of these different items. I'm not going to hit you with the fasting question, but I am going to hit you with the fasting question. I know that there's a lot of information out there, and that when people think of longevity, the first thing they think of is fasting. But my specific question is, in your experience with genetics and precision medicine, is there anything you guys do different or when you approach the patient in terms of restricted eating?
Yeah, we know when we look across like all the literature and research on longevity, the one thing that just keeps popping up in animal studies is calorie restriction. It clearly increases lifespan. So when you apply that to humans, we feel very confident that some form of calorie restriction and fasting is good. We don't know how much, and it is one that can have some harmful side effects. Now, 90% plus probably of Americans are overfed, so they're fine. But we do need to probably talk about the 10%. There are female athletes is the perfect example. A large percentage of them are underfed, and athletes in general will get REDS, relative energy deficiency syndrome. So depending on the patient, most people could certainly benefit from fasting, but there are people who don't need to fast. They need more nutrition, not less. So again, 90% of our patients benefit from fasting. How much fasting is similar to the sauna and cold. We have people work up to it. We want to start off with what they can do, not what is optimal. We may think that quarterly 3-day fast and once a week 24-hour fast would be great, but 3-day fast is a big jump for someone. So we usually start people with just intermittent fasting or time-restricted feeding, just skip breakfast at first and have a 16-8 window or an 18-6 window only within a 6-hour period. So fasting, I think, is definitely calorie restriction, definitely increases longevity. For everybody, it's a little different. Someone who's lean and works out a lot, they probably have just as much benefit from a 16-8 window as someone who is sedentary would get from a 24 to 36 hour fast, because they're just using more calories as well. So again, it's a personalized approach. What's your activity level? What's your body mass right now? And do you have any other risk factors before talking about what kind of fasting and how much?
Along the same lines of fasting and nutrition, is the concept of metabolic flexibility or metabolic health. How does that play into longevity? And are you guys using CGMs or continuous glucose monitors? You hear a lot. They seem to be quite popular these days. Is it something that you guys are implementing? And how important of a role is it to be metabolically flexible for in regards to longevity?
Yeah, we do. So your glucose, your fasting glucose, and your average glucose definitely play a role in longevity. We want to lower fasting glucose. We also don't want glucose spikes. So your glycemic variability is important. And we've had crude measures in the past, which is just measuring a fasting glucose and measuring a hemoglobin A1C to see what your average glucose over time has been. But a CGM is a really powerful tool. What a CGM does, obviously, I think most of your listeners will understand, we're continuously looking at your glucose, continuous glucose monitor. And what that does is it's a really nice biofeedback tool. Just like the Oura Ring we were talking about, it gives you feedback on what's working and what's not. If you wear a CGM for a time period, you really get some nice insight into how your body handles glucose and handles food. So you'll learn things like, for me, for example, I get a really big spike. I remember being on an airplane and getting served like some cheese and nuts and grapes. And I just remember how like my glucose from a small amount of grapes spiked like 60 points. And it was just shocking to see what grapes do to me. Whereas I found like at night, if I wanted to have a small dessert, like some dark chocolate, it was amazing how much smaller the glucose spike was if I had some protein and fat with it a little more than normal. And it's also really interesting to see, for example, how the same food in the morning may not cause as much of a spike as at night. So your insulin sensitivity is different at different times. And if I'm sleep deprived, if I've got a great night's sleep, I handle the glucose really well. Whereas if I am sleep deprived, I get a nice big spike. Or if I eat the same food after a workout versus without a workout, it's amazing how the muscles are primed to take that glucose up and I don't get a spike after exercise. So all these little examples are just things that I've learned about myself just by wearing that device. So it's expensive. We don't encourage it for all patients all the time. But if you can afford to do that and get that insight, it can be a really powerful tool to help change your behavior based on how your body responds to certain foods, not how most people respond to foods.
Yeah, it's been one of the most eye-opening wearables that we've had thus far. Just like you touched on everything. It's just the timing of when you eat. You can demonstrate eating late at night. We all know it's bad for you, but you eat late at night and you have a CGM on and you have your Oura Ring and you see how your heart rate variability gets all jacked up, your temperature goes up, and you have a horrible night's sleep and you have continuous elevated glucose throughout the night. So it's a very, very interesting combination when you start looking at all these wearables. But as you pointed out, they are expensive, so not for every patient.
Yeah, yeah. And I try not to get obsessed with them. if I've got a CGM on, I know what dessert is going to do to my glucose. But if I'm on a date night with my wife and I don't order dessert, I know what that's going to do to me as well by making her feel bad about ordering the dessert. So try not to be obsessed about it, but it can be a really nice tool to give you great information.
Totally. We want to respect your time, Matt. So I'll drop the final question. And you've touched on so many things that I think this is a well-timed question for you. Just for you personally, you know, what makes up your formula for achieving your peak health, at least right now with the best of your knowledge and access to information?
You know, what I'm doing personally is as much as I can, but in context of my relationships. I think people don't focus on the relationships as much as they should. And no matter how important, for example, we say sleep is, if my four-year-old wants to cuddle longer at night and wants an extra story, that's important. If go on a date night, like I just mentioned, and my wife wants to split a dessert, I'll do that. So I am educating myself. I'm always trying to figure out what works best for me, but I'm always reminding myself of that Sophia Loren quote about using our mind and talents and creativity to bring love and life to those people that are important to me. And if you look at the blue zones, I mean, that's probably as big of a component as all these other cool, fancy things. So I do encourage people to educate themselves, learn what is important for them from a biologic standpoint, but not to lose focus of the things that both increase your longevity, but also make that longevity worthwhile, which is the relationship. So to me, that component, I think that's a good place to end, because as scientists and physicians, we don't talk about it as enough, but there's nothing more important than our relationships when it comes to achieving peak health.
Such a great perspective. Thank you.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks for your time, Matt. It was really informative.
Yeah, that was great. Loved it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, here we are. Another episode. Dr. Matt Dawson. Guys, what do you think? That was like, we covered a lot of stuff on that show.
Nothing like a pop quiz in the middle of the afternoon, huh?
No kidding.
He was a good sport. I felt like we nailed him with a bunch of different questions and he had a great answer for every single one.
Yeah. I mean, I like the theme that kept rolling through for me was just two things, I guess, that this concept of just going back to ancestral living, right? Like, especially when he was talking about sleep and going back to like thinking about the, like how we used to sleep and how we can get back to that in our modern world. And then the other thing, just, it just kept coming up over and over again, but just this idea of super personalized, right? Like there's so many different things we can all do. Don't get hung up on, okay, you know, you have to have an Oura ring. I mean, there's tons of different devices out there, but the key is, you know, put some importance to your sleep, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's important for the listeners to notice that he's pretty deep in the game and to realize that there's all this data, you have to put it together, but still step back outside and say what works for you. You know, one item is not sovereign. So
yeah,
you look at the Oura ring, you look at labs, you look at how you feel. And his culminating message at the end was have good social bonds, you know?
So true.
Yeah, the biggest takeaway for me was that, yeah, you have all these fancy things and everybody wants to do the biohacks. Everybody wants the peptides or NAD or all these fancy things, but it's back to basics for him. Just get up, do the, be mindful, social bonds, working out, hot and cold, you know, causing your body to endure some difficulty so that you build up resilience. So the ancestral living thing is the biggest thing for me. And that's really where I've been focusing a lot of my own intention on changing my health. So it was great to hear it from somebody that's, like Rhett said, deep in the game.
Yeah. And to follow up on that. So what I would say is that, you know, in our next podcast, we're going to learn about DNA methylation and the biological clock and all this cool stuff, but to remember, and again, I'm not speaking for Wild Health, but I know that their metrics are still, how do you feel? You know, is this working in your life? Is this working, you know, in your bonds, in how you sleep, that kind of stuff? So,
well, for me, it really hit home in how he wrapped the conversation. He essentially went full circle. I mean, he started the conversation around the idea of, like, let's not forget common sense in a conversation, right, that we have with people coming in the clinic or online, and finished it off with, yeah, all this stuff's great, but don't forget about your relationships. And, you know, there's, you know, untrackable type things that, you know, you have to pay attention to. So, like, don't get too obsessed with all of this stuff. Just a real, he's just a real humble guy from my perception with this conversation, and just real down to earth and kind of tells it how it is, right?
Yeah, and I think he's just been doing it for a while and he's on the same journey that we all are on. You know, he and Dr. Mallon were having difficulties in their own lives and they were trying to figure it out for themselves. And then they just expanded that to their friends and family and, you know, and then came about Wild Health. But we're all on the same journey, no matter if you're a physician, you know, classically trained physician in Western medicine, or you're a functional medicine or integrative physician, you're still on the journey. And that's the key point that I think that patients or clients need to know, is that we're still figuring it out ourselves and we're trying to improve our own health along the way while we're trying to assist you in reaching your peak health.
Yeah. And Mark, even today, remember what we spoke about. So, you know, all this stuff we're talking about, injections, infusions, CGMs, wearables. But today we were talking about breath work, you know, simply doing a little breathing exercise makes you feel great right after you do it.
Yeah, immediately.
So keep it simple, I think, is what you're saying and what he's also saying.
Totally. Awesome. Well, I'm excited. The next conversation you know, never say never, but it might be the last one for this series. Who knows? We might have a few others, but as of right now, we're nearing the end of the series, and then we get to start on a whole other topic, which will be super exciting. So anyone listening, remember to message us if you have any topics you want covered, because these are super fun to find the right guests to bring on and have these conversations. Till the next time.
See you later.
Yes, you made it to the end. Thank you so much for sticking around. Make sure to tune into the next show, which is with Ryan Smith, the co-founder of True Diagnostic, which is the team behind the world's most advanced epigenetic test, TrueAge. Of course, if you're enjoying the show, please drop us a review wherever you're listening. They do go a long way. Thanks, as always, for your attention, and we'll see you next time.